This is Solve It for Kids.
Hello, my amazing and curious friends. My name is Jennifer, the Dean of all things STEM and STEAM, and this is Solve It for Kids, the podcast that gives kids and families a peek inside the real world of scientists, engineers, and experts as they solve problems in their jobs using creativity, cooperation, and critical thinking. And now please welcome to the show my podcast partner, Galactic Space Geek, Jeff Gagne.
Hello, Jennifer, and hello, listeners. Today, we have a guest that is going to take an experiment that I have done with a high-altitude weather balloon and absolutely ramp it up because he's launching it on a rocket.
Yes, he's doing an amazing, amazing experiment. So what problem are we solving today?
Why would you send yeast into space? Fire.
Why would you send yeast into space? Well, this is going to be a very interesting answer. Who is our guest today, Jeff?
Our guest today is Dr. Sergio Santamaria. He is a project scientist for the BioSentinel mission at NASA's Ames Research Center.
Welcome to the show, Dr. Sergio.
Hi, Jennifer. Hi, Jeff. Glad to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
Yeah, well, we're thrilled to have you because the project you're working on is sitting on Artemis and about to head into space, or by the time this podcast airs, maybe it will have gone into space. So, you know, if you've listened to our show at all, you know that Jeff and I are huge space geeks. So I like to start out with, did you always know you wanted to be a scientist when you were a kid?
Maybe as an older kid, I am originally from Lima, Peru in South America. So we have primary and secondary school. So towards the, let's say the 10 or 11 grade equivalent in the United States, I was more interested into biomedicine and sciences. So that's why I got my degree in biology in Peru before coming to the US. Yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic.
A young person getting interested right away in biomedicine. That's not something you hear often. Was there something in your life that sort of lent you in that direction?
Perhaps, yes. A lot of curiosity and having an MD family member wanted to explore different things, right? I was not sure it was going to be biological sciences or medicine, but it ended up being biology at the end.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, and you're working with such cool things like yeast. How did you start working with yeast of all the different things that you could choose?
Right. So as everybody knows, NASA and all the space agencies send a lot of different biological models, which are those little organisms that are used to perform experiments in space. Okay. And why do we use model organisms is because a lot of the stuff that happens in these microbial organisms or small animals, perhaps, they're very similar to what happens in humans.
Oh.
So yeast, specifically what is called budding yeast, is the same one that you guys use to make your bread or maybe for older audiences, your wine, your beer.
Oh, wow.
It's actually very similar inside to what happens in humans. They're very different outside, obviously.
Right.
Sure.
Right, much smaller, but yeast has been used for many, many, many years in different industries to produce biomedicines, being used to produce fuels. And it was the first organism to be sequenced, its DNA to be fully sequenced many years ago.
I didn't know that. That's very cool.
Yeah. It was, I think, you know, like more than 20 years ago, perhaps now. And the main reason why we chose this organism, besides having many of the, it's called the molecular mechanisms, the way things happen inside the cell, including the repair of damage caused by radiation, is very similar to humans.
Oh.
But something that is very important for this mission is you can actually dry yeast. You can buy it at the supermarket, at the grocery store, and you buy it dry usually. So where do we dry it, number one? So you already said that we have been on the Artemis rocket for a long time, over a year by now. We have been on that rocket with all the other missions. So you need an organism that can survive being there for so long.
Right.
And the best way to do that is we dry them or we desiccate them. So we dry them and they get activated or rehydrated in space. Yeah.
Ah, okay. So I have to ask, how do you do that process?
The process as a scientist with my science group was, what is the best way to dry it? And you can dry things many different ways. You can just literally put them on the top of a laboratory bench to dry, or air drying.
Right.
The other option, you use vacuum to help the drying process. And then you use what is called freeze drying or lyophilization, that you pretty much very quickly remove the liquid. And that's what is used to conserve a lot of the foods, including the astronaut foods.
Right.
It's lyophilized.
Oh, yeah.
So, so the method that we chose was air drying. So the simple one, because the cells, our cells, do better when they're just like allowed to dry at a slow rate as compared to freeze or vacuum, that is a much a violent process, right? At least for the yeast, it is, yeah.
Sure. So when it gets up to space, how does it then get rehydrated? Does somebody down here have a button and a little pack of water just hydrates it all?
Right. So we use this fluidic system. We have the biology, so the yeast, the cells, we add them into these microfluidic cards or microfluidic cassettes. We have many of those cassettes, and then they get integrated into what is called a CubeSat, a small satellite.
Yeah. Okay.
So on Artemis 1, they are 10 CubeSats right now. They're all secondary payloads. Ours is the only one carrying biology. And one great advantage of CubeSats, you can automate the process. So even though we can communicate with the little satellite, you know, round trip kind of, and we can send commands, and we can send commands to activate or to rehydrate the cells, the system can do it autonomously. So it has all the sequence of commands set up. This is a 6-month nominal mission, meaning a minimum of 6 months in space. So throughout these 6 months, we activate, meaning we deliver using a system of pumps and valves, these nutrients into each of these fluidic cards. So it allows us to follow throughout the 6 months how the yeast responds to the radiation environment in deep space. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
That's very cool.
So I want to talk about, there's so many things that I could ask you questions about, but I'm going to talk about the yeast, because we have, why would you send yeast into space? So the way, what you're saying is the yeast kind of acts like a human cell would when it's exposed to radiation in space. Is that what you're saying?
No, what I'm saying is, like, it's a model organism, and the way it repairs the damage caused by radiation, a lot of the genes, a lot of the components, the pathways are very similar. So that's why we use these yeast cells. So we're not, and it is important, not just from a human perspective. We, of course, want to know what's going to happen to our astronauts in the future.
Right.
But we will also be using organisms. As you know, we are growing plants in space. Even us, as humans, carry a lot of microbial organisms inside. So we want to make sure that it's not just about, it is important about the humans, obviously. But we also want to point out that in future missions, microbes are going to be more and more important for multiple purposes, including production of food.
Okay.
So that makes a lot of sense on why you're using the yeast. I knew it had been used in space a lot before.
Right.
Didn't realize it was quite so similar in its reactions to a human being. That's another one of those links that, you know, regular people don't usually think about.
No, hey, who would have thought
we're
that?
We're closer to our yeast than we think we are. So we will definitely have some images of these microfluidics cards.
Yes.
On our website for this episode, and they look really cool.
They do.
So will you get these microfluidics cards back?
Yeah.
Will this CubeSat come back to Earth for you to collect them, or do you get all of your information from the CubeSat and we'll never see it again?
The second one. So, unfortunately, once we get, so we're sitting currently underneath the Orion multi-crew vehicle. So after Orion gets deployed and does its thing and comes back to Earth, these 10 CubeSats or small satellites get deployed one at a time. With this momentum, with this deployment, we actually pass the moon and then enter an orbit around the sun, or a heliocentric orbit, and we stay there forever.
So
all the data is going to be transmitted back to the Earth using the Deep Space Network, which is this series of satellites. that send everything via pretty much binary code. So everything is sent back and forward using binary code data. So everything gets translated back on the ground to data that is useful for us.
So this is going past the moon. So that means that it's going to have way more radiation than we would get on the moon. Will this help you understand like what would happen if we went to Mars and stuff like that?
Exactly. Exactly. Oh. So that's we have two primary goals with this mission. Number one was develop the capability. This is the first mission that is carrying biology to deep space. The first mission carrying biology is from NASA since 1972, from the last Apollo mission. And the second objective is to try to understand how a biological organism, in this case yeast, responds to the radiation in deep space, to learn more about what happens on a potential mission like 6 months plus, right? Going, for example, to the lunar surface or staying there or going to Mars, which is obviously a longer mission, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, this is really important mission.
Yeah, that's the goal.
All right. So as a lead scientist for this project, do you and your team have expectations of how you think the yeast is going to react?
The way we perform the experiments in space, as you know, we don't get the samples back, so we cannot really analyze a lot of the things that would happen to them. We actually use what is called an optical detection system. So we pretty much, we have these cells, again, inside these fluidic carts, and we illuminate in these wells. So we have them in little wells, and then we illuminate them at different wavelengths. This means that we can actually get data on how fast they grow and how fast they become active. So we have a special dye that changes color when the cells become active or become, my guess, out of this dormant state being dry.
Okay.
And then we compare that data over the six-month mission. So we get a good idea of the effects of the radiation environment over the 6 months. So we have 18 fluidic carts, and we activate two at a time. So that gives us 9 time points throughout the 6 months.
Okay.
And then we compare the data. Something very important to mention is we actually flew a mission to the International Space Station that just returned to us in August.
Uh-huh.
And that's our microgravity control, because inside the International Space Station, we don't have that level of radiation because the ISS is protected from the galactic cosmic radiation by the magnetic field. So we're protected a lot by that. But we do get the microgravity similar to deep space. And of course, we have ground experiments as well on the ground. We have done a lot of experiments. So in terms of expectations, we will compare that data to what we have done on the ground. Like we have gone, for example, to New York, to the Brookhaven National Laboratory, where they have these very cool particle accelerator facilities.
Yep.
So we expose our biological samples, our yeast, to these accelerated particles like you see in like movies like Iron Man, right? Doing those very cool synchrotrons. So that gives us an idea of the type of radiation that we'll be exposed in deep space, because the no magnetic field anymore, and you're exposed to the immensity of the universe, right? That you get everything, exposed to everything out there. Very those high energy particles. So we have all that data available. We're trying to publish it right now, actually. And we hope that we get to that expected radiation range that we do see a response over time. So the longer the cells are exposed to this cosmic radiation, you expect to see a slow cell growth. The response, the metabolic activity would also get slowed down. And then we do have another instrument on this satellite. It's a detector that allows us to count the amount of radiation and the type of radiation. It was developed by the folks at Johnson Space Center. And we can compare, so we can compare the radiation response in the biology to the actual radiation environment inside the same satellite, which is something that has never done before, which is pretty cool.
Wow, that's amazing. I mean, wow. Now, I have to say, I've been to Brookhaven National Lab, and I actually was lucky enough to get a tour of the particle accelerator when it was off. Particle accelerator. So I'm curious, like, where did you put your samples? You didn't put them inside the tube. You just put them in the, like, I was curious, where would you put the samples so that they would get those particles?
So inside the Brookhaven National Lab, there are different facilities. There are light sources, like actual like photon sources.
Yes.
There are also heavy particle sources.
Okay.
And NASA has a facility called the NASA Space Radiation Laboratory, or NSRL. So we have physicists there that they have developed a system that is designed to expose biological organisms or sensors So it doesn't go into this huge synchrotron, the whole circular accelerator.
Right. That's what I figured.
That's more for particle physics, you know. But this one allows us to simulate that cosmic radiation environment using biological organisms. So we do expose it to the tube, but not to the large tube.
That's too much, right?
Yeah, that's too high. Yeah.
Okay. So I have one more question. So can you give us an idea of what the radiation level is that people are exposed to, as opposed to, say, like X-rays or an MRI? Like, can you kind of explain what the difference would be? You know, like, is this like the equivalent of 10, 15, you know, exposures or something like that?
I don't have it on the top of my head in terms of numbers or amounts, but something that is very important to mention is that the radiation that you get exposed when you do X-rays or go to the dentist, that type of radiation, X-rays or gamma radiation, it's of very low energy. You also get those in space. However, once you escape the magnetic field, the magnetosphere that protects us from galactic cosmic radiation, you get exposed to these very heavy, high energy particles. You get exposed to these oxygen, you know, high energy protons, high energy, very heavy particles like titanium or iron, which by being heavy and of higher energy, they produce more damage. So it's, I would say, it's not necessarily a question about the amount of radiation, but the type, the quality of radiation. So you can probably get exposed to the same radiation dose in low orbit, so on the ISS, for example, and outside the magnetosphere, but the radiation is different. So that's the important thing. And that's something that, unfortunately, we do not have data for biological response, right? We have a lot of sensors out there, a lot of spacecraft.
Yes.
But we have not done biological experiments for that duration of time, which is one of the objectives, you know, try to expose for at least 6 months. That's our nominal mission, yes.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Okay, so this mission is the first one sending biology out past the moon, and it's already on Artemis 1, and we talked about that. NASA is already planning Artemis 2, Artemis 3, et cetera, and those continued missions. Is your team already planning future, either additional or larger experiments, either with yeast or with something else, to continue this study of radiation and its effects?
Yes, actually, we have been awarded a grant to do a lunar surface mission.
Congratulations. That's awesome.
Yeah,
that's
wonderful.
Yeah, we got awarded. It's called the LEIA project. Is for Lunar Explorer Instrument for Space Biology Applications, short for LEIA. Long for LEIA. What this mission is doing is part of the whole Artemis, I guess, the series of missions. It does not have a flight assigned yet, but this one is actually mounted or will be mounted on a lunar payload, a commercial lunar payload lander. So it's going to be sent to space. It's going to be go to the lunar surface, and it's going to have a very similar instrument on the lander, but this time it's a shorter mission. We're talking about second quarter, perhaps, of year 2026 as of right now. So 4 years from now. But the goal here, as you know, the gravity on the surface of the moon is different than the gravity in free deep space.
Yes.
We're talking about, I believe, it's a 6 gravity. Mm-hmm. And this partial gravity has also effects on biology, at least from the experiments that I have been able to see. So we want to know the response to this new environment. And something else that is very interesting on the lunar surface is this cosmic radiation that you see in deep space is actually bouncing back on the lunar regolith, on the lunar dirt.
Wow.
And this bounces back as neutrons. And neutrons are these neutral particles that cannot be stopped, and they can also produce damage. So a significant fraction of the lunar radiation environment comes from these neutrons. So we're trying to understand what is the effect of biology to this different radiation environment and different gravity environment. And we're working with, I'm a co-principal investigator, and my other investigator is also at NASA Ames. I'm interested in the response to this radiation gravity environment. On his side, he's more interested on, can we produce bionutrients? Can we produce food in this new environment?
Oh.
You know, yeah.
Okay.
It's pretty neat.
That's fascinating.
So eventually, do you hope to be able to use some of the stuff you learned from here to like build better spacesuits or better shielding or something for humans? And everything else, I guess, right? Like not just humans. Right. We're talking about plants.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a question that I get asked all the time, and even at the highest levels within NASA, which is, why do we care in terms of, like, we're not flying humans, yes. right? We're flying these yeast that I used to make beer, right? For example. But so it's a capability. It's a new, it's the first of its kind because it's carrying biology to deep space for a long period of time. So we hope that we, the next series of missions, now we're talking about, can we shield the biology using better materials or new materials? Can we treat the cells to be more robust against this radiation environment? Can they become more resistant? I know you guys heard of these little water bears or tardigrades.
Yes.
So these little animals are super resistant, right? They have been exposed to through space, to vacuum and radiation.
Yes.
Part of our project involves potentially, we're not sure yet, grabbing some of these proteins or genes from tardigrades and putting it on yeast. And why do we care about it? Because if you have a microbial organism like yeast that produces yogurt or probiotics or biomedicines, you want them to be good. You want them to not be affected by radiation. You want them to last for a long period of time. So we're also looking at how to improve microbial organisms for future long-term missions or to live on the lunar surface. So it has a series of objectives, and with BioSentinel as well, looking at how we can improve shielding, which involves suits, because suits at the end of the day is another shielding protection system.
Right.
And yeah, and how we can protect, we can give antioxidants to yeast as well. Yes, like we give antioxidants to humans. So it's a learning process for everyone. And we hope that we are contributing at least a little bit to the program, to the Artemis missions.
I think it's so cool. I mean, you have these tiny little organisms and you're going to find some hopefully pretty amazing things that could have long reaching, you know, ways to help solve problems.
It's a fascinating connection. And the fact that with BioSentinel, you're doing it inside of a CubeSat, which is already small enough by itself, but just these microfluidics cards that are so small.
Yes.
And the amount of data and information that you're going to get from them, it really is fascinating what you and your team are doing.
It's mind-boggling.
Yeah, thank you very much. Yeah. Thank you. And that's, and thank my engineers, really, because I was not involved in building that.
We'll be sure to pass that along.
It is amazing once you see, I think you, Jennifer, saw the model that we had on the Artemis 1 exhibit. It is amazing the amount of stuff that we can fit in there. And of course, it helps to build better systems for future missions, right? Which is something very important, something that we do a lot at NASA Ames in the Bay Area of San Francisco, is to make sure that whatever we do helps future missions. And that has been the case since 2006 when we built the first BioCubeSat with GeneSat-1. So we have been improving the technologies step by step. Yeah.
That's
now
cool.
Finally going to deep space for the first time. Yeah.
Can you very quickly explain what the size of a CubeSat is? Because when I saw one, I was like, it's tiny. Like, I couldn't believe. And then it all folds out, right? Because it has the solar panels or whatever?
Yeah, so the CubeSats, or CubeSats in general, are categorized as CubeSats based on cubes and or on units, or also called U's, letter U's. And ours is at what is called a 6U. So all the payloads on Artemis 1, all the satellites are 6U. They all have to follow the same weight, the same shape, the same volume. So 1U, it's a cube of 10 by 10 by 10 centimeters. So imagine a little box of Kleenex, tissue.
Yes.
Yes.
A little bit more than that. And so you put six of them together, and there you have a BioSentinel style CubeSat. And people are doing, and they have been used for many years now. The idea of CubeSats comes from 1999. So they are using a lot for education purposes. You can see a lot of high schools, colleges, universities using CubeSats to train the next generation of scientists, engineers. That's one of the main objectives of using these satellites. They can be, they're lower cost in most cases.
Yes.
They can be repeated. They can be, so that's why they're launched also from many different countries nowadays. They're trying to take advantage that they can be sent with other larger missions and do their own science. That's a very important use of these small satellites.
I love that. Six Kleenex boxes. Got that, Jeff?
I sure do. For the lunar mission, just thinking about the size of the CubeSat you were just describing, for the lunar mission, not to take you off your current project, will that one be about the same size?
It's actually smaller. What we call the instrument that carries the biology and all the liquids and all the pumps and valves, We call it the biosensor. We were very original and call it the biosensor. And the biosensor instrument per se is for you. So four boxes, four small boxes. That's pretty much what we're sending to the... So it's a little bit smaller. It has other instrumentation, like I told you, in case of radiation sensors. But the biological instrument is a little bit smaller because we don't need... in this particular case, we'll get the power and the data management through the lander. So we do not need to have solar panels or propulsion or other things that BioSentinel
does. Okay, I understand. That's really cool.
Will you recover the ones that you're taking to the lunar surface?
No, we're not there yet.
No, you still can't. Okay, someday.
But you know, we're already talking about, and you know, on the surface of Mars, and looking how we're collecting samples on Mars. In future missions, we'll take the samples back to Earth, right? That's it. That's what the last lander is doing. So I'm hoping that future iterations of landers perhaps give us a capability, but that's just me dreaming.
I would imagine that costs more, right? So yeah, it's a cost issue.
Or even better, get our astronauts doing the experiments there.
There you go.
Yes. Yeah. And I loved hearing what you just said of that's me dreaming. I mean, you are the lead scientist on this project that's doing this first biology that far out ever. I am actually reeling this all the way back down to us little people in the science world. I am actually flying some yeast on a high altitude weather balloon in 3 days this coming Saturday. It's the first time I've ever flown yeast. It was actually my wife's choice because she is going to then bake bread with it, bake two loaves of bread to see if there's any difference. When you said, I wasn't going to bring that up during this interview, but when you said, that's me dreaming, and the fact that you are a top scientist in the world of what you're doing, and to know that you have, hey, this is this really cool stuff that I'm already working on, but I still have my own big dreams of what I want to keep doing. That just sounded great.
That's cool. Will there be a difference? Dr. Sergio, do you think he'll see a difference in his bread?
It depends. Is he being exposed to the environment outside?
Yes. So the payload box that it goes up in has holes cut in it, and the yeast is in an open bag. So it will be exposed to roughly 100 to 105,000 feet of atmosphere.
Yeah. So the main factor at that altitude is, of course, ultraviolet radiation, temperature. And the pressure even changes. Many people like to use balloons or high-altitude drones to simulate the Mars surface environment because it's similar pressure, similar UV radiation, and similar temperatures. So you might get something different. It really depends how you really... because you don't need a lot to protect against UV radiation. That's why you only need to use your sunblock, right? Your sunscreen. Yes. But if you have a plastic or something that allows UV to pass through... you might just get a difference,
That's fantastic.
Right. When we bake these two loaves, I'll be sure to add the results to
the website.
This episode page.
There you go. Well, we have reached the time in the show, because we could talk about this forever, where we ask our guests if they have a challenge. And I think this kind of goes a little bit with what Jeff was talking about. So what is your challenge for our listeners, Dr. Sergio?
Right. So, you know, I mentioned that you can use yeast that you can buy at the market, the grocery market. You can buy it dry. You can buy it. There are different forms that you can buy it. But you can use this to make bread. You make your pizza dough, perhaps. Mm-hmm. And all you need is a little bit of water, a little bit of flour, and your yeast. Something you're going to notice is going to rise, right? It's going to start increasing. Like, that's a very cool thing to see. The reason why this happens is that the yeast start making bubbles. They start producing CO2 gas, and that interacts with the flour and it starts expanding. And I like that challenge because that's something that you see in space or anywhere. Yeast produce bubbles. When you open, you drink your beer, the first thing you're going to notice is a pop. So many times, the yeast is still alive, it produces these bubbles. So something that terrorizes fluidic engineers in space is bubbles, because you don't want bubbles interfering with your experiment. So in our case, our engineers were smart enough to protect us against bubbles. We have a whole system to prevent bubble formation. But the yeast over time will produce bubbles. Huh. But by that time, we're done with the experiment. So this is many days later. And we have nothing happens because we collect the waste. So everything goes to a bag in there.
Right.
But it's just the principle. You also get it when you make your bread. So if you guys want to play with some yeast, go get the very cheap little envelopes containing yeast, flour, if you want to even try to bake it, just put some sugar, some salt, and something else, and then look at your dough start growing. It's pretty neat.
That's okay. Amazing. That's a fun challenge. I like that too.
Well, it's simple, and you can do several different things.
Yes. Yeah. This has been fabulous. We have really enjoyed having you on our show. Yes. Thank you so much for being on Solve It for Kids, Dr.
Thank
Sergio.
Thank you, Dr. Sergio.
Thank you very much.
Wow, that really was interesting because I have sent yeast up on a high altitude weather balloon, and to know that these microfluidics cards are going up into space with yeast to learn even more about what happens to them in space, I love this, and I love how much we can do with yeast right in our own kitchens, which is going to connect us to this episode and what Dr. Sergio and his team are doing.
Yes, exactly. I mean, it's so cool because I met Dr. Sergio, as I said, at Kennedy Space Center when they were doing all the pre-launch stuff for Artemis. And I was stood there and like probably talked to him for a half hour. I was like, this is science that's going into space and it's going to help humans, right? It's going to teach us about how humans can live in space. So I hope everybody goes and does his challenge and just kind of looks up how many different types of food have yeast in it. There's a lot.
There's a lot. Right, Jeff? And don't forget to get some packets of yeast and some sugar. There's lots of different experiments, and just watching it to see that reaction happen. Sometimes we don't want to do challenges or experiments because we don't have the patience. With this one, you're not going to need patience. You are going to see it happen, and it is fascinating.
It is. So make sure that you try this challenge, but then follow the Artemis launch and Orion. We will have information on our website to see if you can follow the BioSentinel mission and find out what happens with it. It might take a little while, but it's very cool. You will be able to look for that on our website, which is solveitforkids.com on this episode page. But also, we'd love to hear what you think about it. So tag us on our social media. We are at KidSolve at Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. We'd love to hear from all of you and know what you think about this awesome project.
Go Dr. Sergio. Go BioSentinel mission. Go Artemis. Until next time, this is Jen and Jeff for Solve It for Kids.